he's dedicated to the idea of serving love. He is a Minnesinger, and the Minnesinger were poets who competed to sing songs about love, and the Germans used the term Frau Minne to mean a goddess of love, and she's also called Frau Holder. So it's almost as if he started serving the goddess Venus right from the start. And what's rather disconcerting about Tannhäuser is that rather than going from a rather austere view of love and then becoming enamored of love's fleshly pleasures, he starts at the fleshly end. He starts at the Mount of Venus, this mountain, a mythical mountain called the Horselberg. And one of the strange stories about the way the opera came about was that Wagner had, as he usually did, written a poem called The Mount of Venus and Venusberg, and he read it to a group of his friends. One of his friends was the composer Robert Schumann, who promptly lost a lot of Wagner's friendship by saying, but Wagner, it's an anatomical term, mons veneris.
I was wondering when we'd get onto that.
And Wagner...
It's very rude.
Wagner was absolutely appalled. He thought this was the most shameful thing that Schumann could possibly have done because it pointed to the fact that it was sexual love that was the principal interest at the beginning of the opera. Then, of course, Tannhäuser says the name of the Virgin Mary and is projected away from the Venusberg and its fleshly pleasures to the more austere slopes of the Wartburg, where he then goes and competes in this festival.
Peggy, it's not quite that clear-cut, is it? It's not black and white.
No, it certainly isn't. And, of course, the thing is that Tannhäuser is an empty space, in a way. He almost doesn't have a character because he gets filled up by, you know, this fabulous rolling waves of sexualized music. But then he cries out the name of the Virgin Mary and suddenly, you know, he's turning again to Elizabeth. So he's very much something that is being swayed all the time by whatever particular emotion it is that's taking him over, whether it's sexual or whether it's religious. So he's very much a figure from that point of view. I think when you say, Simon, about Schumann and the technical term, Wagner's libretto makes it very clear that he's playing a lot with quite explicit sexualized imagery, you know. And, of course, that's why Tannhäuser was the opera that got taken up by so many decadent artists later on, because it lent itself to this erotic falling over into the pornographic scenarios that it later occupied.
In fact, Aubrey Beardsley was planning, just before he died, to do an illustrated Tannhäuser.
Which and it was I called Under the Hill.
Under the Hill. And
it would have been, everything that goes with that.
I think
that.
It would have been a real hair curler. I do.
Well, mine's curly enough already.
I mean, it's an interesting opera because Wagner himself, he constantly went back, he revised it, and at virtually on his deathbed, I still owe the world Tannhäuser. He obviously had enormous affection for it.
Yes, I think the affection is there as much as in it, for any reason, is that, again, it's a self-portrait, and Tannhäuser is a self-conscious artist. Wagner was a self-conscious artist. Tannhäuser is rewriting the rules of the art because he insists on singing a song which the rest of the court think is deeply inappropriate, the song at the end of Act Two, which drives everybody out. They all flee from the hall, leaving only Elizabeth to defend him. And that's what Wagner felt he was doing. He was driving everybody from the hall by reinventing the art of opera.
Except that, of course, the song that Tannhäuser sings in the music hall, this great contest piece, is a very organized, rigid structure. So it has verse, chorus. And it contrasts absolutely beautifully, and as you say, Simon, reflects Wagner's own enterprise with the third act story of what happens to him in Rome. And you get this long narration about, I traveled there, I saw the Pope, I begged for forgiveness, it was refused me. It's very fragmented, it's actually very psychological. And of course, in the meantime, Wagner's been working on Tristan, so the Tristan elements have crept into this revised version of Tannhäuser.
Yes, I think one of the things we have to keep reminding ourselves is that Wagner had most of the stories for most of his operas in his head by the middle of the 1840s, long before being sent into exile. He had a magnificent library, which he lost after he fell out with the Saxon regime because he'd participated in revolutionary activities, but he'd been reading deeply in Old High German and Middle High German literature, and he'd got all of the stories he was going to work on. So we find there are elements of the Parsifal story in Lohengrin, we find there are elements of the Meistersinger story in Tannhäuser, and at one point he thought Meistersinger was going to be a sort of comic tailpiece to Tannhäuser, that moving away from the aristocratic Minnesinger, you then went to the bourgeois Meistersinger. And so in all of this, Wagner's showing himself as taking inspiration from this old German mythological material and this extraordinary literary material, which had only just been rediscovered in many cases, and presenting himself as, I am the leader of German art, I am going to take up this, and this is how I'm going to lead my way forward. And the other point, of course, about this split between great formalism and much freer material is exactly what Wagner's doing in the three operas leading up to the Ring Cycle, namely The Flying Dutchman, Tannhäuser, and then Lohengrin. He's breaking away from grand opera, he's breaking away from number opera and moving towards through composed opera, but he hasn't got there yet, and he won't get there until he gets to Rheingold. But at this point, we can see that he's on his way to that revolution in thinking, which won't really come about until well into the early years of the 1850s.
Because some of the most dramatic sort of juxtaposition of form grafted onto a sort of later language come quite early in the opera, when we get the overture moving into the Venusberg movie, which of course comes much later in the way he constructed the opera.
Yes, so these things are all coming together. And interestingly, of course, the ballad of Tannhäuser dates back to, you know, like the 13th century, something like that. But the immediate text that precedes Wagner is Heinrich Heine's comic poem about Tannhäuser. And the key things that Wagner adds are the idea of Tannhäuser and the song competition, so himself as composer, himself as singer, and Elizabeth. And these are the two things that get added in and that make a very distinctive and important presence in the opera.
Yes, there's a very interesting thing about the way Wagner drew from Heinrich Heine. And, of course, Wagner had made friends with Heine in Paris. Heine was Jewish, and that had been an obstacle in Wagner's relationship with him, as it was with Mendelssohn, as it was with Meyerbeer. But Wagner took two really important stories. First, the story of the Flying Dutchman, which came from the memoirs of Herr von Schnabelowopsky, a completely marvellous name, which tells the Dutchman's story but puts a spin on it. It's actually being performed in a theatre while Herr Schnabelowopsky is going off and seducing a blonde lady in a box at the theatre. And in exactly the same way, the Tannhäuser story comes up as almost an ironical view, a satirical view of this great legend, and Wagner then goes past Heine's rereading of it, and I think it comes in the Elementengeister, goes back to the early versions which had just been edited by the Grimm brothers, and went to the original sources and effectively took off all these layers of sardonic rewriting and tried to go back to a much more clear, in his view, pure form of the work.
Now, for about the first 130 years of Tannhäuser's existence as an opera, it was taken fairly much at face value on stage. And then about sort of 40, 50 years ago, directors started to try and strip away the realism, I suppose, and get to what they felt the opera was about. And the artist, you know, Tannhäuser as artist, Tannhäuser as the individual against society, seemed to be a sort of productive line of argument. I mean, do you think that works?
I think what happened to a lot of Wagner production in the years after the Second World War, and in particular in the German-speaking countries, was that there was a feeling that you had as a director to make it clear that you were aware of the negative aspects of Wagner's personality, and that Wagner's cultural nationalism, which was also a political nationalism, had led to the nationalism of Nazi Germany, and his anti-Semitism had led to the anti-Semitism of Nazi Germany, and that if you were a director and you didn't make this clear, that you'd understood this, and this is where the culmination of this, I think, was in the recent Düsseldorf production, where the whole thing was done with Nazi imagery, bells and whistles and swastikas and goodness knows what. I think there are other ways of looking at it, and also in looking at the artist as the hero, rather than turning him into a Nietzschean Superman. Nietzsche is post-Wagner. I think it's worth making the clear point that Nietzsche follows Wagner. He was a contemporary of his, but he learned a great deal from Wagner. And in exactly the same way, both Freud and Jung are post-Wagnerian. It's very difficult to do a production of Tannhäuser in particular, but Lohengrin would be another example, without feeling that Wagner was obviously up to the minute on psychological theory. Actually, he preceded a great deal of that theoretical writing. And so if we're doing productions nowadays, we have several layers to strip away. As you say, there's the layer of, as it were, historical anachronism by assuming that everything that happened in the 20th century could be prefigured from the 19th century, but also strip away the idea that Wagner comes, as it were, prepackaged with a Freudian or a Jungian reading, which has got then to be addressed in the production.
But there's still a core of an emotional truth. I remember seeing a vividly a production, quite a conventional production in some ways, but Elizabeth is waiting for Tannhäuser to come back. In this particular production, she was actually a nun by now, so she's wearing a nun's robe. And as the stage fills and fills and fills with all these ragged pilgrims, I remember Gwyneth Jones fluttering up and down, searching for Tannhäuser among the crowd. And honestly, it was so moving, I could feel it now. And that truth, and in some ways, I'm now thinking, you said Tannhäuser was the hero. All of a sudden, I think Elizabeth is the hero of this opera, because she stands up for him. You know, right at the beginning, she resists the whole opprobrium that is cast upon him by the community. She is utterly faithful to him and whatever belief in him she may have. And that's triumphant.
No, I think you could make a perfectly good case for that with several other Wagner operas. Many people feel that Brunhilde is the most heroic figure in the ring. Isolde clearly has a heroic status. And Elsa in Lohengrin not only is a heroic figure and has enormous courage in confronting this wrongful accusation made against her, but she also stands up to Ortrud, who's there speaking for the old gods and putting a vengeful view about how she's going to take vengeance on Elsa and destroy
her. It's interesting, given that, you know, actually Wagner's view of women, if I may, in this opera, is very polarised. You know, you either have the sexy Venus, or you have the pure and nun-like Elizabeth.
So which does make you wonder whether, it's ridiculous to, it's a sort of how many children had Lady Macbeth question, but it does leave you wondering, as you do with Lohengrin, whether there was any scope in this relationship in the first place. How could they possibly have married if he either wants the woman on a bed or on a pedestal, but there's no sort of middle ground. There's no over the breakfast table.
Yes, I don't think there's much just ordinary married life in Wagner, no.
Do you think one of the things I enjoy most about Wagner's autobiography, Mein Leben, is that in the midst of the writing about the various operas and the ideas he'd had are wonderfully banal domestic details. He and his wife get a parrot, and his wife teaches the parrot to sing tunes from Rienzi. And you think, it's not the
And he
sort
also
of
has
thing
to wear silk underwear all the time. Yes, all right.
It's not the sort of thing that ever gets into the operas, whereas Richard Strauss, does write both Ein Heldenleben, and he also writes the Sinfonia Domestica, and he writes which is the opera with
Intermezzo,
which of course is an intimate family portrait about a dreadful misunderstanding between him and his wife. Frankly, if you'd had a Wagnerian opera showing the dreadful misunderstanding between Wagner and Minna simply because he couldn't meet an attractive and intelligent married woman without falling in love with her, it would have been a marvellous work. It's the sort of the missing Wagner opera that we don't talk about.
Is there a whiff of misogyny hanging over Tannhäuser, do you think?
Well, he's a 19th century man, you know, of course there is. He is a product of his time. That said, I think that, especially perhaps this opera above all others, because it does talk about sex quite, you know, explicitly, it comes out of an anxiety that is very much part of what is going on in the 19th century as women are making claims for, you know, employment rights, custody of their children, divorce, and all these other things. Very many people get hot under the collar and think it's all to do with, you know, body parts.
Simon, you were saying that the opera, in a way, prefigures so many of the things that were to come later. That, you know, there's renunciation, which crops up in The Ring, there's a curse, Lohengrin, there's a Liebestod. But at the heart of it, there's this singing competition, yes, which is in the centre of Meistersinger as well. It's a kind of interesting conceit where you've got singers on stage in an opera playing singers.
Yes. I think this is something Wagner is hugely drawn to, as he is again in Die Meistersinger, where most of the people on the stage are actively competing in an important competition, and the first thing we learn in Meistersinger is what the rules are of the competition. And the beautiful point in Act Two, where Elizabeth greets the hall with the phrase "Dich teure Halle" and says, "Dear beloved hall, I see you once again." And it's almost a way of warming up the auditorium for wonderful things to come. I've been to several Cardiff Singer of the World competitions, which again are great song festivals, where the soprano who chooses to sing Dich teure Halle, as Lisa Gastein did on a memorable occasion, almost bound to win the competition. It's just such a great way of launching forth, and I think the Albert Hall will feel very well greeted this evening.
And of course, if Elizabeth was allowed to take place in the competition, she'd win hands down.
Of course she would, absolutely. That's why she's been kept out of the whole issue. No, I think there's something marvellous about Wagner's total understanding about the competitive nature of music and singing. And you read what he has to say about singers. He writes to tailor what he's writing to the voice of an individual. If a different singer has to come in, he'll make adjustments. He's constantly aware that singing is a living art form, each individual singer is different, and that both the creativity of the singer and the interpretative strength of the singer are crucial for the composer's work to be heard. Wagner must be the only composer we know to have given complete performances at the pianoforte, singing all the voices of some of his operas, and frankly, I'm not sure I'd want to hear him in soprano register, can you imagine? But what we do know is that Wagner was absolutely aware that none of this could happen if it weren't for the singers and it weren't for the orchestra and it weren't for the staging. And so he's celebrating his own art form.
Yes, because he is a man of the theatre, and you've left one out, and that's the audience. Because, you know, we need an audience as well. You know, you have all those singers. It's a communal act. It's both the people on stage, it's the people backstage, it's the people front of house, and it's the people sitting there in the auditorium. Well, and he actually stages audiences very brilliantly.
Yes. Well, one of the brilliant things of that, of course, is it's not just Wagner drawing from his readings of Old High German and Middle High German literature. He was intimately familiar with the Greek tragedies and Greek epic, and he understood the idea of the chorus, and much of what he did to reform opera was to bring a Greek tragic approach to the chorus, who are, of course, the audience. They are the people who are making a moral judgment. They are reacting ethically to what they see and hear. They are the people who say, oh, this is a dark day, this is a terrible deed, what an appalling thing, he ought to be ashamed of himself. All of those things come from the mouth of the public, and it's Vox Populi, Vox Dei. We almost have a judgment being given from the stage by people participating. And, of course, the tendency, and in many festivals, the chorus for an opera like Tannhäuser or Lohengrin, I've seen in the Savonlinna Hall of the Theatre of Olavinlinna Castle, and you'll have 180 choristers who absolutely envelop the room. They go right the way round the side, so you can't look around and see who's a chorister and who's a member of the audience. And the feeling of unity with the performers and the audience is absolute.
Yes, and I'm reminded too now of the way that sometimes he uses the chorus just as a single person. In Tannhäuser, of course, the place where this happens is towards the end when Wolfram sings the song to Elizabeth, but about the evening star. And of course, the early ancient Greek poet who wrote a poem to the evening star is Sappho. Mm. So all of that learning is coming in as well. Mm. But he's our representative because he's singing